accession number 28361, Reel 30.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 30. You were saying that you also did some trading.
Yes, I traded my jersey for a poncho liner.
Not your only jersey?
Not my only jersey, no. Which I did through my American ops officer, on the basis that he would be better placed to do it than me.
Vieques, is that in the Western Caribbean or Eastern Caribbean? Do you remember?
I'd have to look at a map to remind myself. Do you want me to go and look at a map?
Is it one of the American Windwoods?
I think it is one of the American Windwoods, yes. Yeah. But I better just look at a map if you want me to check it. I'll just go and do that.
So it's next to Puerto Rico.
Next to Puerto Rico and between St. Thomas, St. Croix.
How long were you actually on?
Vieques. I suppose we were there for about a week before we re-embarked. And then I suppose we were there for about 4 or 5 days for the second exercise. We must have spent about 9 days there, I suppose. A little bit longer, perhaps. Nearly 2 weeks. Just nip out. I'll be back in a second.
Did you go on to any further exercises from Vieques?
Yes, we went to an exercise on a place called Andros Island, which is in the Bahamas.
Was that a training island, or was that an ordinary?
Well, no, it was a normally pretty sparsely populated volcanic rock island, it's a good lesson actually in the dangers of doing recces from the air, because the exercise had been set up by a staff officer who'd gone out from my superior headquarters to recce the island. He never actually landed on it. He just flew over it in a light aircraft. And he thought that the soil was all sand. But when I went on my recce, which I went just before we were going to actually do the exercise, I discovered, and my 2IC went with me, because we had to cover quite a large area, and so we split it up between us, that in fact it was not sand at all. It was some of the most challenging type of terrain I had ever come across. It was all volcanic, with razor sharp ridges, as if someone had just set the volcanic lava like that. And there were huge potholes, some the size of this room, which went down and gave you access to the sea. Some of them were a mile or two inland, but they had tunnels into the sea from them.
And these were these part just as a result of the lava flow?
This was the lava flow, I think,
yes.
And they were surrounded by, there was a lot of what I would call dry secondary jungle around it. It was very thick.
A scrub,
but some of it grew the height of this room, but it was all close together, and actually getting through, you could take hours to get through it.
What kind of plants were it? Was this thorn?
It was sort of viney, thin, miserable little scrubby trees, but very thickly packed together in places. And then the rest of it was this sharp stuff with potholes, real ankle breaking stuff. And it took. I had an SBS section with me on this deployment, and it took an SBS section in daylight, with no opposition, an hour to advance half a kilometre. It was so thick, and so very difficult for movement on foot.
Were they having to hack their way through the ground?
Well, no, they were having to press it aside and that sort of thing, and then slipping down, and then they'd have to go round a pothole the size of this room, otherwise they'd have fallen 200 feet into a pit full of water, which they would never have got out of. And imagine at night going into a place like that. And so I had to completely recast the exercise, which was terribly ambitious.
What was the original plan of the exercise?
The original plan of the exercise was some kind of enemy, which we'd have to sort of advance against in a rather conventional way. And I said, well, in fact, this exercise is only scheduled to last 3 days. And if we've got to advance one in the island to the other in 3 days, well, we'll take 3 months to advance from one end of the island to the other.
How big was the island?
It's quite a long island.
It's a long, thin island.
It's a long, thin island. Several miles. And we can look it up in a minute. And so I said, right, we'll recast this. And what we'll do is we'll give the platoons, the troops, a bit of fun. We'll have troop locations, and we'll pretend that we've already occupied the whole of this, and they are now in the pacifying phase of a counterinsurgency. And really, it's low level, trying to find sort of little bands of chaps
mopping up
with tiny little areas of responsibility, because that's all they'll be able to cover in the time. And that's the way we played it. But the moral of the story was that the guy doing the recce had never actually put foot on the place. He'd just flown over in an aeroplane.
Where had he flown from?
He'd flown from Nassau, because it was within helicopter range of Nassau.
And had this island been used before for exercises, or
not?
Was it new?
Yes, it's been used. It's been used before by small bodies of people. It'd been used, I think, by ships' marine detachments years before, where they just land 20 of them into place and play around for a bit and then come off. Mm. It's quite an interesting area because it's very deep water, just off Andros Island, where the continental shelf does that into and it's where they used to. It was called the Ortec range, where the submarines used to play about on training.
What submarine infiltration route into?
Well, no, it's where they used to go and train, because there was a range there where they could do all sorts of whatever submarines do in very deep water, free of obstructions and obstacles. Mm. And when you flew over it, you'd fly out to sea. Over reefs and things, and then suddenly the thing would just drop away, and it would just become deep, 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 that deep blue you get in very deep
colour.
Water. Just like that, it changed colour, you know, as if someone had just carved a knife down the side of an underwater cliff. So that was Andros.
Were there any locals taking part?
Well, there were the police, the Bahamian police, and I think the whole exercise had been dreamt up as a sort of political how should I put it, sort of comfort factor feeling to the Bahamian police.
And what role were they playing? Were they playing a military role?
They were playing a paramilitary role, sort of advising. They were all like the RUC and their relationship to the army in Northern Ireland in the early days.
Were the Bahamian police habitually armed?
Yes.
How did they do?
They were fine. I mean, we just attached policemen to these locations.
Yes.
And they played a sort of, RUC type role with the military against this local, in quotation marks, terrorist group, which was provided by my people. I mean, I provided the enemy.
So you had some guys playing terrorists and the rest trying to hunt them down.
That's right,
police. Did you have a police presence in your headquarters?
Yes. I had an inspector or something like that.
Was there actually any sort of terrorist threat or potential threat?
No. The only threat actually is drug smugglers. The real threat is drug smugglers.
Was that current at the time?
It was beginning to. I think it was beginning to get quite relevant. It's pretty relevant now, I think.
Mm. It's become more and more.
Become more and more. So I don't remember there being any great sort of briefing that there was a drug threat. Mm.
What did the Bahamian police think of this then? Because if they were exercising an anti-terrorist role, and there was no terrorism on the horizon.
I think they enjoyed it. They had fun.
They
liked playing soldiers. Really. I mean, I didn't detect any sort of angst in what we were. I mean, we didn't. We said it. It wasn't the Bahamas. We pretended it was some mythical place somewhere else.
Somewhere else.
Yeah, mm. Yeah.
What sort of weapons and equipment did they have for
They had small arms, and that was about it. So Sterlings and that sort of thing.
Mm.
Nothing very major.
Mm. Were they competent at handling their weapons? And
I mean, we didn't fire, so from what one can tell, they seem to be reasonably at home with them. Yes, I mean, there was no live firing, so whether they were or not, I don't know.
And the, you know, it was a smooth relationship.
Yeah, it was fine. It was all pretty. It was low level, pretty. How should I put it? Innocuous sort of stuff, really.
Mm. And this was 3 days. Did you suffer any injuries as a result of this?
Oh, we had a few broken ankles and that sort of thing, but not serious stuff.
Mm. Mm. It sounds like the sort of terrain that is designed for causing.
Oh yes, I mean had one tried to play serious stuff on it, we'd have had a lot of injuries.
Mm.
Because there was a sort of main track that ran intermittently up the coast, and then there was the odd sort of track which went in like that. But other than that, there was no agriculture, no reason to go inland.
Mm.
The economy of the place seemed to be based on fishing. So there was no requirement for the inhabitants to go inland in any distance at all.
So just a coastal fringe.
Just a coastal fringe of settlements. Mm. Yeah, mm. Yeah.
Did you have much contact with the locals?
A bit, but you know, just it was all very cheerful in the villages and that sort of thing. It was. Yes, I mean they came round camp and that sort of thing. And it was all very low key.
Mm. And. So you had a three days on Athos,
yeah,
and then it sounds like you were having a very active tour,
with a great variety
things to do.
Well, we had one thing I haven't covered yet. We had on the way there, we went to Jamaica, which was really a sort of jolly. There was no training to be done at all,
Was this just making your mark with the local?
Yeah, yeah, and it was really for the benefit of the ship, so they could have a sort of, you know,
a run ashore.
In fact, I rather discouraged the idea of run ashore, because Jamaica at that time was quite a nasty place with a lot of drugs, a lot of violence, and so forth.
Mm. Was this the beginning of the grand political ructions that have been going on in Jamaica?
It's time to remember. This was 1976,
yes.
March 76. February, March 76. I mean, I can't remember what the political situation was. Fairly quiet. But what we did was I sent the companies off into the sort of interior of Jamaica, and they set up little sort of company camps, and they did. They were only there for a couple of days. They did a bit of sort of jungle navigation and that sort of thing in the bush. Because I wanted to keep them out of the town.
Mm.
And I took commando headquarters by vehicle across the island. And the night we arrived, there'd been a cocktail party on board. And one of the guests on board had said they had a villa on the beach on the other side, which they hadn't dared to go to for years or several months, anyway, because of the violence and problems and burglary.
Was this political trouble in all?
No, it was just straight criminal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, can we use your beach and barbecue there? And she said, oh, it's terribly dangerous. I said, well, I should be okay because I'll have about 100 Marines with me, and I don't think they're going to take us on. And so we went across and barbecued in their garden, and the whole of this strip of obviously what had once been luxurious villas on this lovely beach, all empty, the odd caretaker, all with sort of broken windows, and the gardens were in absolute shambles of disrepair. And we had quite a pleasant sort of, you know, banyan by the beach and cook up, and drank some cold beer and slept out under the stars in our newly acquired poncho liners on the beach, and then got back in our Land Rovers and drove back the next day.
Who turned up at this cocktail party on the
ship? Oh, they were sort of everybody from the equivalent, I suppose, of the Prime Minister or some senior government figure, I can't remember who was there, through to the British High Commissioner, local battalion commander, brigade commander, local Jamaican army, police, and some residents, some of whom were European.
Jamaica Regiment was supposed to be very smart in its
purpose, yes,
and so on. Did you have any?
The only contact I had with the Jamaica Regiment was very. I was invited up to their depot, which is up in the hills, and I can't remember the name of the place. It has a very English-sounding name, and it's actually rather like going to what I remember, the sort of as a child in India, Indian Army depots in the hills, in Darjeeling and places like that. You had this depot in rather pleasant surroundings, a rather pleasant climate, because it must have been at about 4,000 or 5,000 feet. So it was nice and cool, and you looked out over Kingston, which was sweltering away below you, and a very nice sort of little officer's mess, beautifully sited, and it was just like a British regiment officer's mess. We had tea there and then came down, but I remember that. And also, the other thing that we were grateful to the Jamaican Army for was they had a helicopter squadron, and one of my drivers stupidly decided to go off on a swan on his own, and drove into a tree and nearly killed himself, and was in a very bad way indeed. In the night, the Jamaican Army Air Corps equivalent flew a helicopter sort in and went and brought him in and took him to hospital, saved his life actually. So I was extremely grateful to them for that.
Did you have formal liaison arrangements with them, or was this done?
This was done sort of
informally.
Informally, yeah. But we were only there for a couple of days, really, you see.
So
3 days
max.
It was a courtesy call, and really to allow the sailors to stretch their legs. And I was determined my men would not stretch their legs in the sort of shanty town of Kingston. So I kept them out.
Do you know if any of the sailors got into any trouble?
I don't remember, no, I don't think so.
So it's Jamaica, then on to...
Then on to Andros, and then with Bahamas. Mm. Then after that we went to Florida, to Fort Lauderdale. Mm. And that was definitely a 5-day jolly in Fort Lauderdale.
What sort of facilities are there in Fort Lauderdale for jollies?
Well, all sorts of things. I mean, everything from sort of bars and clubs and kind people who took people out swimming and fishing, and you could also go across to the other side of Florida, to the Gulf side, and there was some quite good fishing there, and it was generally a sort of time for everyone to sort of disperse and relax and enjoy themselves.
Just 5 days R&R.
5 days R&R, and then back to across the Atlantic via Gibraltar. To run up the rock and then back home.
Why is there this custom of running up the rock every time you visit Gibraltar, is it?
Well,
based on a historic event or something.
The Marines captured Gibraltar in 1704, and also then held it in the siege.
Yeah.
So we look upon it as belonging to us. And it's the regiment in a sort of rather inward-looking regimental way that the British are so good at. Mm. And it's the only battle honour that we carry on our colours, of course, Gibraltar. So it has sort of regimental
connections.
And so, for example, as we were approaching the day before, I decreed that the account of the seizure and defence of it would appear in the daily orders, just to remind people what it was all about, even though it wasn't the day that it's normally celebrated on. And then everyone runs up to the top of the rock. The first chap up there gets a crate of beer. And then you all come down again and that's it.
So you ran the rock.
Ran the rock. Mm. And then we had, I suppose we had two nights there, something like that. Mm. So everyone sort of dispersed and did their thing. Quite good shopping in those days. We visited the local resident infantry battalion, which was, I think, the 2nd Green Jackets. Had a clay pigeon shooting competition against their officers. And then left and sailed back to Plymouth and disembarked again by helicopter. And then went straight into a period of training for Northern Ireland and training for presentation of new colours.
When were the new colours due to be presented?
They were due to present on the 1st of July that year.
So you're getting close.
We're getting close, and we're now in April.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work to be done, because the day the colours were presented, the day after the colours were presented, we were due to go to Lydd and Hythe to do our NITAP package.
Before going to Southall Marsh.
And we had an extra package where we used to do a week. If you were going to a rural area, you had a week in Stamford training area as well. So there wasn't actually a great deal of time. And the way that I split the time up was we would do preparation of drill and that sort of thing in the mornings, and Northern Ireland training in the afternoon. Mm. And then, of course, there were people to send away on courses. There were people coming in and giving us instructions. So it was a very busy time.
What sort of training were you doing for Northern Ireland before you went to night at Lydd and Hythe?
We were doing things like learning the yellow card, so people had it absolutely in their minds.
They had to learn it by heart.
They had to learn it by heart, because you can't get it out and start looking at it when it all starts happening. You have to learn it by heart. Things like search techniques, things like vehicle checkpoint techniques. It was individual training, because the collective training was going to be done at Lydd and Hythe. A lot of shooting, zeroing of weapons. We had ranges which we could use. And also, we were very lucky, because there was a little mini dry training area around the barracks we were in, which was called Seaton Barracks, which was Devon, small fields, just like South Armagh. So we were able to do
rural training
on our back doorstep.
Was this mainly patrol exercises?
Yes, because we were operating in South Armagh in those days. You operated never less than 3 4-man bricks. Yeah. So it was 12 men out on the ground. Yeah. And it was a question of how the patrol commander maneuvered his bricks around, and never going through a gate. You always went through the hedge.
Beside the gate.
Preferably the thickest part of the hedge, which was the most difficult part to get through, because if there was a gap in the hedge, that's where the IED would be, or that's where the sniper would be aimed at. And it was all individual training, really. And then chaps would come and lecture to us from NITAT and then, of course, at the same time, I and the company commanders were doing recces in Northern Ireland as well. We'd go across and do recces. So all this was, sort of 1 minute you would be standing on parade with your sword, waving it about, and the next minute you'd be creeping around, and we'd do night work as well. So we kept everyone pretty busy.
When you were doing searches, what sort of things were you practicing searching for? Was this searches for weapons?
Weapons. Mm-hmm. So search teams, you formed up search teams who were given specialist training by the sappers. They went away on courses.
Mm. Did they go to Chatham for that?
Yeah, they went to, I think it was Chatham where the search teams were trained at. And of course, I was going to also take my affiliated battery to Northern Ireland with me as well.
Presumably in the infantry role.
In the infantry role. So they had to be retrained from being gunners into being infantry.
The vehicle checkpoints, was there anything particular about the way those were to be conducted?
Well, it was the fact was that the VCPs, the vehicle checkpoints, were mainly going to be in rural areas, and therefore there was a problem of protecting our own VCP so that it didn't become a problem in itself, didn't get sort of ambushed while it was setting up a VCP. And the whole business of how you mounted it and then took it away, and what you were looking for in a VCP. And at this stage, they had just started bringing in Northern Ireland, and the thing, and I can't remember what it was called now, but it was computerized vehicle license plate system. And I can't remember what it was called, but it was, you know, the first time that IT had been used in that way.
This is for suspect vehicles.
Yeah, and what happened? Well, yes, it was. And it also, they collated all the information in a way that they were able to trace where a vehicle had been. So every time it went through a VCP, the chap would come up on the radio and he'd just pass the vehicle number over the radio to the centre, where it would be tapped in, and it would then go onto a database, and that vehicle could then be traced around wherever it went. So if it kept on crossing the border, that was probably suspicious. And also, certain vehicles, of course, had become tagged, as it were, as being suspicious. They could be followed around, too, in that way. I can't remember what it was called. It had a code name, and it had only just been introduced. And so we had to introduce our guys to this, so that was something else you could do.
You hadn't been to Ireland before, had you?
No, only visiting, yeah.
But quite a lot of your soldiers...
Quite a lot have been there. Before. Oh, yeah.
So presumably they already had quite a lot of these bases. So they would be on refresher training for skills they'd already acquired.
Yeah, but remember that some of them, like the ones you met, had been in Anderson Town the year before.
Yes.
Now, they had to relearn a whole lot of skills for the country, which were totally different.
Yeah. Well, they weren't only... I mean, they had a chunk of Anderson's Town to patrol, but then they were also patrolling in the rural hinterland outside it.
Sure.
So they're having to combine urban patrolling with rural patrolling.
Yeah. But South Armagh had a quality all of its own.
What was that based on?
It was based on the fact that the border was very close, and so large chunks of it could be observed in perfect safety by the IRA from across the border, and they could shoot from across the border
into Northern Ireland
without any fear of anything happening to them, other than the fact you used to return the fire, of course. There was a huge IED problem in South Armagh. There was no vehicle movement south of Bessbrook, so you didn't take vehicles out at all. So everything was on foot. An enormous amount of helicopter movement. Everything was done by helicopter. So patrol commanders were going to take their chaps out by helicopter, move them around, and then be lifted out by helicopter. And we also used to stay out two or three nights, because I believed that in that way, because you were being observed all the time during the day, at night you could move somewhere else. And then pop up in an unexpected place, set up a VCP for an hour, and then just disappear, melt back into the countryside. And by sort of good soldiering, you could keep the opposition on its toes and not be a target yourself.
This is essentially back to fieldcraft.
Back to fieldcraft, yeah.
And you mentioned the hedgerows in South Armagh. Were there any other distinctive?
Well, they were very thick, and they were blackthorn. The patrols used to carry secateurs to snip their way through.
Gardening secateurs.
To snip their way through. So, or if you wanted to set up an OP in one, you'd snip your way in. And the farmers used to beat their hedges every day with dogs. So OPs didn't last long because they'd be found. The other thing we had in South Armagh was the railway, and I'd been told that there'd been a spate of hijacking of trains, that if there were any more hijacking of trains, I could expect to find myself on the next flight home.
Oh.
So I had a...
Was that your top priority then?
No. My top priority was to stop intersectarian killings. There'd been a lot...